Well, hello there. Welcome to the Strange and Deadly Show. We haven't been on this feed for a while. I'm Christopher Clayton and I'm joined by...
Tom Elliott.
And here we are, offering you something a little bit different. You may be surprised to see this. You may be thinking, what on earth is this? Where's my double bill of the Section 3 list? Where is it? What are you guys up to, messing around with superheroes there in the background? Get back on here. Well, we are on here... sort of, and we do have plans for the Section 3 list. We are going to get back to it and we are going to finish it, but Tom and I have been working on something a little bit different. Our podcasting minds are always at work. It's not often my mind is at work, but when it comes to podcasting, it seems to get going. It seems to be like an engine that just keeps on going. And yeah, we've come up with a few ideas, and one of them has kind of solidified into this new show that Tom and I have been doing called Strange and Deadly's Television Terror. And Tom, I'm going to go over to you so that you can explain exactly what Strange and Deadly's Television Terror is and why we're hearing an example of it here on the Strange and Deadly feed.
Okay, I will try to be brief on this, but it's not going to be easy because a lot of factors kind of come into it. But we made the Strange and Deadly Show. We called it the Strange and Deadly Show for a very special reason. We didn't call it the Section 3 list show or anything like that because we thought once we do that list, we might want to do something different, you know?
Mm.
So we wanted to have that option. Now, way back when we were deciding what to do together, we had a little list of ideas. One was a Video Nasties podcast, but Christopher Brown was doing it, so we decided not to do that. The other was a Tales from the Crypt podcast, and for one reason or another, I can't remember why, we decided not to do that one either, but then we settled on the Section 3 list. That's what we decided to do on the Strange and Deadly Show, with an idea that one day, when we got to the end of that list, we would do something else, you know, whatever that might be. So I think the Strange and Deadly Show is not so much a show about... those type of video nasties. I think it's more about us focusing on, you know, different areas of horror and the things that we want to explore in it. And that might take the form of, you know, short lists or longer lists. It depends on, I think, how we're feeling now. I mean, recently there was an iTunes review where someone seemed to be quite incredulous at the fact that I hadn't seen Happy Birthday to Me for several years. And I think the thing about me and you when we podcast is I'm not really sure how important that is that you need to watch Happy Birthday to Me, you know, every few years or you're not a proper horror fan or something. But I like to explore different things and there's a reason we never kind of try to do what all the other horror podcasts do, you know. We wanted to do something a bit different, didn't we? And while I think... the topic of Strange and Deadly's Television Terror has been done. It hasn't been covered extensively, like a lot of the same subjects are on horror podcasts. So we're going to give it a go and kind of go back to one of those ideas that we had when we started the podcast. Okay, you talk now because I'm starting to bore myself. But so what have we decided to do?
Yeah, well, I like to think of Strange and Deadly as being... an evolving idea, because for a while when the superhero podcast idea came up, which is our other show Lost in the Omniverse that we do together, that idea came up and we kind of thought, well, maybe when the Section 3 list is done we'll say goodbye to Strange and Deadly. And it's quite clear to me that there are some passionate fans of it. There's some passionate detractors as well, one or two that we get along the way, but you can't really do much about that. It doesn't particularly bother me, but you know, it is what it is. But I quite like the idea now, and I think we're developing this idea of it being something that evolves and kind of changes. And once the Section 3 list is done, it doesn't necessarily mean that Strange and Deadly is over, it's simply that it evolves and becomes something different. So what Strange and Deadly's Television Terror is a, I suppose, sort of similar to the Strange and Deadly show in that it's a double bill format, but it's two TV shows, as the title would suggest, Television Terror. And they're two TV shows that are actually very different to each other, but they are anthology shows. And one of them has been brought to me by Mr. Tom Elliott here and is a carryover from his work on the Twilight Zone podcast. And one is a show that we're going to do the Tales from the Crypt podcast. Well, we're doing Tales from the Crypt episode by episode and going through it. So it's Night Gallery. That's the show that you, Tom, kind of brought to me and said, hey, would this be an interesting idea if perhaps you and me could look at this together? I already know it, you know, decently well. And of course, I'm a big Rod Serling fan. That's your good self. As everyone will know who knows the Twilight Zone podcast. Me, I'm a bit of a newcomer, really, to the work of Serling. Don't know that much about him. Anything I know about Rod Serling tends to be fairly surface level. So why don't we talk about Night Gallery and let's pair it up with Tales from the Crypt. And that's what the idea was. And we created Strange and Deadly's Television Terror. And we've recorded one episode of it. And we decided, well, look, here's what we'll do. Because the Twilight Zone podcast fans have been very supportive of you, you've just won an award, Tom, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. We thought it would be a great idea if we launched Strange and Deadly's Television Terror on the Patreon and the Night Gallery portion of it, because that's, I suppose, the most applicable to Twilight Zone podcast fans. We'll have that be a part of Tom's Patreon indefinitely for the foreseeable future. I think it will always be an exclusive to that, won't it, Tom?
Yeah, that's right. That section will.
Yeah, that section will. So the Night Gallery stuff will be exclusive to Tom's Patreon. And the Tales from the Crypt side of things, although they're going to be joined together, why don't we take the Tales from the Crypt portion? Because Tales from the Crypt, although it's an anthology show and there, of course, there are lots of different stories. Every episode is a different story, of course. Why don't we take that? Because it's a little bit trashier, I think. And it suits the Strange and Deadly mentality a little bit more. Because if you know this show, you know that we tend to be a bit, or I certainly do, tend to be a bit rowdy and a bit ruder on the Strange and Deadly show. And on the other shows that we're doing, I'm a bit better behaved. I still manage to get a few swings in here and there, but it tends to be, you know, for the most part, I'm a little bit better behaved, a bit less rude. And so we thought, why don't we take the Tales from the Crypt portion out and offer it to you folks here on the feed for free after we've finished the Section 3 list. And so the Strange and Deadly show lives on, but in another form. So that's what Strange and Deadly's Television Terror is.
That's right. So it all sounds very complicated, but it's not really. So basically, Strange and Deadly's Television Terror is going on now. You know, like I said, we've done that first episode and it's over there on Patreon for supporters at the $3 or more level. And you can get to that at patreon.com/Twilight Zone Podcast if you want to check that show out. But we also decided to put it here in this episode now for people who want to check it out and see whether you actually like it and so on. And then when we finish the Section 3 list, then we will start to put in those Tales from the Crypt segments here on the main feed. Now, a lot of you are probably sitting there thinking, well, when are you going to get that Section 3 list done? We've been waiting and waiting, and I appreciate that. And, you know, we do apologize. But like I said, you know, we like to mix it up, I think, and focus on different things, and we enjoy doing our superhero show as well. But I think once we get to the end of Phase 2 on the Marvel films and Lost in the Omniverse, we're going to come back and chip away at that Section 3 list a bit more. Whether we complete it all in that run or we just, you know, do half of it or something, I don't know yet. But we do have plans. So that will happen this year with the way the Marvel films are. And we're going to chip away at the Section 3 list a bit more, aren't we?
That's right. I mean, at the moment, as of this recording, we have 3 more films left in the Phase 2 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So we only have those, and then we can take a bit of a break from Lost in the Omniverse for a few weeks and concentrate on Strange and Deadly for a bit. And we have, at last I counted, 9 episodes left. That's 9 double bills left to get through. So it's achievable. You know, the thing is, like, I think if we, you know, had been a bit more on the ball, if certain life events hadn't happened or certain things at work or whatever hadn't happened, maybe we've gotten through this a bit quicker, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we can't do much about that. We also really wanted to launch Lost in the Omniverse because we were finding, weren't we, Tom, that we were bringing our superhero chats into the Strange and Deadly show. And we just thought, okay, we've got to kind of stop this and bring it off and make our own thing out of it. But 9 episodes is achievable. I don't know whether they can all be done this year. Hopefully we can get through a big chunk of them.
Mm.
But I would like to think that at the very least we can get you the Tales from the Crypt episodes, assuming you don't go and subscribe to the Patreon, which of course is entirely up to you. I know Tom and I would appreciate your support there, but we also appreciate your support here. You know, even if you're not giving anything, as long as you're giving your listenership, that's great as well. So I would like to think that we could start getting you the Tales from the Crypt episodes by the beginning of next year. I mean, maybe that's optimistic. I don't know how you feel about it, Tom, but I would like to think that we can we can make some headway with this, and we can start getting you from the Tales from the Crypt episode. So finishing the Section 3 list, and then that will kind of be, if you like, phase 1 of Strange and Deadly, and then the Tales from the Crypt episodes, one by one, we review those, we bring those to you. And actually, by the time we get around to that, there should be quite a few that go up. So you might have quite a, I don't know whether we're going to put them up one per week, Tom, or whether we're going to sort of release all the ones we've got so far. I really don't know how that's going to work, but yeah. There should be quite a bit to get through there. And yeah, that will be. And then when we're done with that, who knows what the next evolution of the Strange and Deadly show will be. It can be sort of unlimited in its own way. We've had ideas, haven't we?
That's right. I mean, and I think what's come out of this is we are thinking long term. I think best case scenario, because we did think, you know, are we going to stop it now after the Section 3 list? But I like to think we're at a place where, best case scenario, we can actually have Lost in the Omniverse and the Strange and Deadly show coexisting, because once we catch up with the Marvel movies and the DC movies, and that will take a little while to get through, I think we could do it on a more seasonal basis. You know, we will go from one to the other in some way or another. You know, we'll decide that down the line. And you know, if Tales from the Crypt doesn't really appeal to you, I hope you'll still check out the shows and enjoy them. But we're even thinking of what we can do after that. And one of the ideas is a bit more in tune with the Section 3 style of horror. And it is quite an interesting one. So I think we love the Strange and Deadly show, and we love the brand. We also love Lost in the Omniverse. So this Strange and Deadly's Television Terror is a way of us, one, you know, keeping the funds going on Patreon, because that pays for the website. You know, we couldn't host this many podcasts and this many episodes without the support of people, you know, helping us out. But also, you know, we are thinking long term, and I think in one form or another, the Strange and Deadly show is going to go on.
Definitely. I mean, you must be thinking at this point, how on earth can Tom Elliott stand podcasting with this guy and potentially for many more years yet to come? I don't know. If you listen back to the episodes of The Strange and Deadly Show, the older ones, you might think to yourself, how's he putting up with him? Well, I don't have an idea. I don't even think Tom knows. But somehow we seem to be thinking about the future and what we're going to do. And it's exciting, you know, to have ideas and to think, OK, maybe there's actually a future to this and it can go beyond the limits that we set ourselves. And yeah, I'm really excited about what's to come. Now, I do know, you know, whenever we do an episode of Leto, Lost in the Omniverse, the superhero show, I'm always aware of the fact that there are plenty of people who listen to the Strange and Deadly show who aren't interested in superhero movies, and that's absolutely fine. You know, that's just the way of things. Not everybody likes superheroes and comic books and all the rest of it. You know, just because Tom and I love them doesn't mean that everybody who listens to this show will love them. And we've been, I think, very lucky that a few people that I know of anyway, that people who've communicated with me that love this show, have listened to Leto on a regular basis just because they like our chemistry, Tom. Like listening to us talk about things, even if they don't particularly understand or particularly care for superhero movies. So I'm always aware of that, always cognizant of the fact that you miss your horror podcasts. And what I can say is that we're going to bring more of them to you. And as Tom says, once we actually catch up with the comic book movie universes to where we're not releasing an episode, you know, we don't have to release them quite as regularly, or we're not even sure what the plan is there. Once we catch up, we have to work that out. But I think you're going to get more shows appearing on this feed. And That's an exciting thing, I think.
There's a lot going on, you know, changes to the website, all kinds of stuff. So just watch this space. But for now, I hope you enjoy this first episode of Strange and Deadly's Television Terror. Like everything, you know, when you start to approach new material, you have to feed your way around it. And I think this one's a bit serious and a bit sort of ponderous, because, you know, the Twilight Zone podcast tends to be like that. But Night Gallery is a bit more of a different beast. You know, some of those episodes, I think it'll get a bit more laid back once we get into the rhythm of it and be a bit more like the Strange and Deadly show rather than the Twilight Zone podcast.
Yeah, it may not be quite as perverse as the Strange and Deadly show can sometimes get, because I also have to be, you know, cognizant of the fact that there are Rod Serling fans who are listening to it and fans of your work, Tom, on the Twilight Zone podcast. You don't want to particularly hear somebody talking about knobs and other such things. So you have to be a little bit better behaved, but it'll still have some of the fun in there. That's the main thing. And yeah, I mean, this first episode, let's be honest about it. I'm green and you're overprotective. That's what it is on the episode. I'm green and don't really understand what I'm talking about when it comes to Rod rod sailing, and you're a little bit, I think probably, although I have to say, this is you that pointed, that these are things we found within ourselves rather than, you know, you found that within yourself when you were listening to it. I have to say, when I was recording it, I didn't get that vibe at all, but that's just inevitable, you know, two people coming together who don't really, you know, with Tales from the Crypt, it's a little bit different, actually, because you, when you get those episodes, you know, I've seen quite a few episodes of Tales from the Crypt in the past. It's a lot I haven't seen, and there's some that I probably won't remember. You've seen a whole bunch of them as well, Tom. So that, I suppose, in a way is less, you know, I'm less green and you'll be less, you know, protective of it. In fact, not protective at all. So it'll have maybe more of the fun vibe. But we'll get there, Tom. I think we'll get there and we'll settle in, and it'll be something. I mean, not to say this first one isn't enjoyable, but just that we'll find the rhythm of it as we go along. But yes, please enjoy your taster here of the double bill of Strange and Deadly's Television Terror, where we review a double bill of Night Gallery and Tales from the Crypt. We hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you soon on this feed for another episode of the regular Strange and Deadly show, where I believe we're talking about two films with dead children in them, Tom. Communion and something else. So we'll see you soon here on the Strange and Deadly feed. Please enjoy this episode.
Yeah, we hope you do. So bye for now.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Night Gallery.
Now that's entertainment.
Good evening, and welcome to a private show discussing two television programmes broadcast here for the first time on the Patreon page for the Twilight Zone podcast. Each programme is a classic in its own way, but to do these two shows justice, I've had to merge two of the podcasts of which I am a part, the Twilight Zone podcast and the Strange and Deadly show. Tonight, we'll capture on a canvas the first episode of this horrifying hybrid. This one we'll simply call Strange and Deadly's Television Terror. So with the Strange and Deadly name comes a very strange and deadly co-host, a podcast and veteran of 10 years or more, and my good friend, who have I got with me tonight?
It's Christopher Clayton. Hello, buddy.
Hello, Chris. So here we are in our new show. It's essentially the Strange and Deadly show, but we're sort of switching up the format with a new topic, something that we're both quite excited about. So just quickly before we dig into it, I thought maybe we touched upon this in our little intro show, but what are you looking forward to? What are you hoping to get out of this show?
Well, you know, we're going to be exploring two shows here that ran for quite a long time, especially Tales from the Crypt. It's a show that ran for 7 seasons, so you've got many years worth of shows there, all sorts of different stories. I suppose the latter point is what I'm looking forward to the most, really, delving into a different story each time around. Several different stories in the case of Night Gallery, and, you know, sort of exploring, seeing different actors, you know, some of them, you know, prestige actors, certainly. Just seeing a very different side of things than we normally see. You know, when we do the Strange and Deadly show, we're doing a double bill of films. So it's two films that, you know, they tend to be quite rigid in their story, whereas here there's room for all sorts of different stories, tales, characters. So I think that's what I'm looking forward to the most. Certainly on the Night Gallery side of things, this is a show I've never been exposed to before. I really know nothing about. So that for me is a real, an exploration of something I've been curious about. The Twilight Zone itself is something that's been on my list for quite a long time, as you well know. You know, one of those, the list that you have in your, the mental list that you keep in your head where you go, okay, one day I'm going to really sit down and go through that. I'm going to marathon it. And it just hasn't happened yet. Night Gallery, this is kind of my, I suppose, my introduction to the world of Rod Serling. So on that side of it, Tales from the Crypt I'm familiar with. There's a lot of it I haven't seen. The same for you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But Night Gallery, completely new to me. So I feel like, from my, and I suppose I'm saying this from my perspective, perhaps we can hear yours. That's what I feel I'm getting out of it, an exploration of things that I haven't really seen before.
I think for me, because I spend so much time in the Twilight Zone, I often do neglect Rod Serling's other work. And, you know, this is a big one in a way. And like I said in that little intro we did, it is seen as the sort of lesser of the two. So I think what I'm looking forward to, I have been exposed to some of Night Gallery before. I watched along to a degree when Christopher Brown did the Night Gallery podcast. But I don't know it as intimately as I know The Twilight Zone. And I'm looking for that Serling stamp, you know. I'll get into the sort of a little bit of a history of it in a moment, but I'm looking to see, does Rod Serling bring that quality that of writing that he did in The Twilight Zone, where he really tells us something about our lives and how we live? Can he bring that to a horror show? That's going to be an interesting thing. And with Tales from the Crypt, I guess I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, is that just a thriller week, or does that have any sort of levels to it as well? You know, there's nothing wrong with being quite a surface show that's all about the sort of the thrills and the chills, but I'm looking forward to seeing, is there more substance to that as well?
But I think what you're going to find with Tales especially is that there's quite a few stories in there of things being turned around on the protagonist. So, you know, they want something, they desire something, and then they might get what they desire, but then find out that actually they didn't really want it in the first place, and it kind of comes back around on them. So I think there are levels to it. It is trashier than, I mean, look, I've only seen this first episode of Night Gallery the pilot that we're going to talk about in a minute, so I don't know how it's going to pan out. But certainly Tales is a trashier show in general, but there's a lot of really, really famous actors, you know, famous actors of the 80s in particular, I suppose. But, you know, going back further than that, who, you know, are very well-known actors and so bring a level of gravitas to them. So I think you're going to be surprised by the depth of some of the stories, but some of them will also be quite fun and trashy at the same time. And I think Night Gallery, even from, you know, a cursory glance at it, when Rod Serling comes on, you can tell that there's a classiness to it. There's a classiness that he brings to it and an intelligence that he brings to it that I'm really looking forward to getting into. They're quite different shows, I think, but, you know, the anthology aspect of it, I think they link together quite well at the same time.
Well, that juxtaposition, I think, is going to be really quite interesting. So why don't we start out? I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but why don't we start out with a little history of the Night Gallery?
Good evening, and welcome to a private showing of three paintings displayed here for the first time. Each is a collector's item in its own way, not because of any special artistic quality, but because each captures on a canvas, suspends in time and space, a frozen moment of a nightmare. Our initial offering, a small Gothic item in blacks and grays, a piece of the past known as the family crypt. This one we call simply the cemetery. Offered to you now, 6 feet of earth and all that it contains. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Night Gallery.
So the story of Night Gallery begins in 1964 when The Twilight Zone was cancelled and there was talk of taking the show to another network. Now The Twilight Zone, although it's sort of well revered now, and it was at the time, it often struggled to really get renewed each year and its luck ran out. Now, the only problem was that CBS owned the rights to the name Twilight Zone, and the president of ABC, who were interested in the show, suggested a change of title to Witches, Warlocks and Werewolves, which was the name of an anthology book that Rod Serling had edited in 1963. So the name suggested a more horror-centric B-movie type of approach. So Serling suggested the title Rod Serling's Wax Museum. And in each episode, him acting as host would uncover a wax exhibit and tell the audience its story. But ABC stuck to their guns, and that was the end of that. Now, in 1967, three novellas were written by Rod Serling and released under the title The Season to Be Wary, and it included the stories The Escape Route, Colour Scheme and Eyes. Now, although the sales weren't strong on that book, it seemed to focus Serling into a more gothic horror frame of mind, and here the idea for The Night Gallery was born. But despite Serling being a household name from the Twilight Zone, in the late 60s the anthology series as a television format was starting to wind down and was seen by some as old-fashioned. And when Serling left a meeting with Universal, which he went to discuss producing the new series, he wrote to his colleague Bill Sackheim, and in that correspondence he wrote, "I walked away with the impression that I'm in trouble once they start shooting." Now, this statement was to become quite prophetic, as Serling, having been working hard on The Twilight Zone for 5 years, never had the control that he had with that show, with Night Gallery. Now, Night Gallery was greenlit at Universal for a TV movie stroke pilot, and this was actually a big hit. But the producer Serling was working with, Bill Sackheim, didn't want to commit to a series, and while Serling wanted a series, he didn't want the same executive control as he had with The Twilight Zone. He said he was in his 40s now, he didn't want to be on set each and every day all the time, so he wanted to be involved but not to the same degree. So when the series was commissioned, Sackheim left and was replaced by a man who will come up quite a bit when we go through the series, and his name was Jack Laird, a man whose vision for the show often clashed with Serling's. But that's a story for another day. So in this one, Chris, you know, Serling really had the reins on The Twilight Zone, and the whole point of that show was to be able to tell stories with a real amount of social commentary hiding in plain sight, if you like. So he could tell stories about racism, about, you know, all kinds of social things, and disguise them as science fiction. But it seemed that by the end of it, the fight had kind of been took out of him. So when it came to Night Gallery, he didn't really want that level of control where he was just there day in, day out. So he kind of put a bit more faith in the studio to kind of carry it, and he would write some of them and present the show. But ultimately, in a sense, that was his downfall. But so, you know, I will bring that up as we go through the episodes, but that's a kind of potted history of the Night Gallery, if you like.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, how long did he do the Twilight Zone show for?
Well, it was on for 5 seasons. But, you know, he had a really great producer working with him for a lot of that, who they saw eye to eye on everything. He had control over it. You know, the network would give him notes, and sometimes he would act on them, sometimes he'd be like, no. But, you know, they call him the angry young man of television, and I don't necessarily believe that's true. I don't get that anger as such, but he was very driven. But I think by the end of it, a bit of the fight had gone out of him, you know.
I think there are some people who are just naturally very creative. Mm. He obviously sounds like somebody who's like that. And, you know, it seems like he wanted to kind of imprint his vision on The Twilight Zone. And also, working on a TV show, it sounds like hard work. Mm. And you got 5 seasons worth there, and you're very creatively involved, as he seemed to be. I don't blame him, really, for feeling like, okay, I kind of want to do this other thing now and explore different kinds of stories, but I don't necessarily want to be quite as hands-on. And then you were talking there about the producer, what was his name, Jack Laird?
Jack Laird, yeah. Uh-huh.
Jack Laird. And there being a conflicting vision there, it may be one of those things where you sort of start something up and say, okay, well, look, you know, you can kind of have the reins of this a bit, I'll still be involved. And then you see what's coming out of it, and you go, well, actually, I kind of want it to be this way. You can never really completely leave it alone.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that. I'm interested in fact, I'm actually considering getting a book on Rod Serling. Just to help this along. You know, I don't know how much it will play into the reviewing of Night Gallery and the episodes of it, but I would like to learn more about the man, because he sounds like he's very driven.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like he knows what he wants. He probably was a bit bossy, but you can tell me whether that's true or not. That's the impression I get, that he was maybe a little bit bossy in the way that he did things. But some of the best things that have ever been made have had somebody behind it who's a bit of a powerhouse, and it sounds like he was very much that. But you get to a certain point in life as well where you think, okay, I kind of want to be a bit more hands-off here, because you only have one life.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of need to live it at some point. And even though the Twilight Zone, as you say, you know, it probably didn't have the reverence that it has now. I mean, now it's hard to imagine a world without the Twilight Zone now.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
if you're not a big fan of it, or you don't know much about it, like myself, you know that it exists, and you know that it's really, really important. What an interesting man. What an interesting man.
I think I can see why you might think bossy, but I would think more just... a very clear vision of how he wanted things. Now, from what I've read, he didn't like his dialogue to be changed, and that'll come up when we talk about Eyes. But in other senses, he was a great collaborator. He was always happy for a director to have their vision and that kind of thing. But you're absolutely right. You know, you get to an age, and I think it's the same, you know, you see it with rock musicians or musicians of any kind, really, where their best work is sometimes in their early days, isn't it, when they really had that drive, and then they start to release these rubbish albums later. And that's obviously not to say Night Gallery is rubbish, but you can really understand him wanting to take his foot off the pedal a bit. And it's kind of the same as, like, you know, Chris Brown did the Night Gallery podcast where he... done it solo and had clips and trivia and that kind of thing. But, you know, he's done that. So I just want to talk about it with you and the audience here on Patreon. So, you know, I'm taking a bit more of a laid back approach to it with this than I do with the Twilight Zone, where I kind of do more of the heavy lifting. But, you know, I'm glad you're interested in him. That's always a good sign. So that's really encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on one of the points you made there. Chris Brown's podcast was very much about really delving into the history of the show and delving into each episode with trivia and, like you say, clips and all the rest of it. This is more of a discussion-based podcast where it's just, you know, us. If you know us from our other podcasts that we do together, we like to have a good discussion. This one's a little bit different because we're going to keep it a bit more family friendly and a bit snappier, but the heart of it really is just us talking about it and talking about these episodes. So yeah, it's different in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I get it, man. I totally get it, of wanting to just to not always have to, because you and I are pretty, you know, we're perfectionists, aren't we, in a lot of ways when we do podcasts. You know, when we were doing the Lost in the Omniverse, which is our superhero show, we did the Patreon for that. And we were releasing bonus episodes. You know, most people would just throw the bonus episode out there with sort of minimal editing and everything. We were editing it like a main show, you know.
Yeah.
Because you want to sort of put quality on it. So it's nice in a way. You know, when you're presenting Night Gallery to me, I get to sort of step back a bit. And then when I present Tales from You, you get to step back and just sort of enjoy the discussion of it. So that's what we have in common. If we have anything in common with Rod Serling, I think you probably have more in common with him than I do. It will be that.
good. Okay, well, why don't we get into the Night Gallery then? And I'm going to present to you this first episode, Chris. It's a kind of television movie stroke pilot episode. So it's a bit longer than the usual one. I think they ran maybe like an hour or something in the regular episodes, but this one is more like an hour and a half. So should we get going?
Definitely, let's do it.
Okay, so let's talk about the first story in the pilot called The Cemetery.
Well, as I breathe and live, if it isn't Osmond Portefeuille. Osmond Portefeuille.
If there's nothing else, sir, I thought I'd lock up and retire.
Yeah, that is your life, isn't it, Portefeuille? Locking up and retiring. You know, to my dying day, I'm going to carry a picture of you walk through life. You know, stiff back, straight legged. Carrying a tray and towels over your arm and a reproven look in your eye. Hey, you know that look. Now, don't you, Portefeuille? How shall I describe it? Like a bank manager finding an incorrect balance.
First broadcast on November 8th, 1969, written by Rod Serling and directed by Boris Segal. William Hendricks is a wealthy recluse whose health is failing him, with only his faithful butler, Portefeuille, we're going to hear that name a few times, to look after him. He has little left in life to enjoy, but he still tries to continue with his lifelong passion of painting with the help of Portefeuille. His nephew, Jeremy Evans, a self-proclaimed black sheep of the family, comes to his uncle's house and doesn't try to disguise the fact that he's here to collect his inheritance when his uncle passes away. While Portefeuille isn't around, knowing that Hendrix is particularly vulnerable to the cold, Jeremy opens the window in his bedroom and places his uncle in front of it, causing his condition to worsen, and he dies soon after. Although he disapproves of Jeremy, Portefeuille must stay on as a butler of the house, seemingly to supplement his meagre allowance that Hendrix has left him in his will. Now with his uncle's fortune and estate, Jeremy is the lord of the manor and lives his life accordingly. But he begins to notice that a painting in the hallway that shows the house and the family cemetery changes every day and seems to be indicating that his uncle is going to rise from the grave to exact his revenge. So, before we get into the story, Chris, because it's not something that really happens on television these days, unless you look at something like Lemony Snicket on Netflix.
Mm.
Here we have this man, and you've spoke about him briefly, Rod Serling, coming up and telling you a little bit about this story that he's going to present. First impressions of this kind of introduction, because obviously it's something that I come across every episode of The Twilight Zone, but what do you think?
Yeah, I really enjoy this, I have to say. I mean, I know a little bit about Rod Serling, and I've seen him before, so it's not like I haven't seen him intro something before, but there's just something brilliant about him coming in, explaining what's going to happen, but sort of introducing us to what lies ahead. And he's a classically sort of a classy looking man.
Mm.
You know, presents the painting there, takes the cloth off of it, and there it is. And we sort of move into the painting, and there's the story. I really enjoy this. I really enjoy this aspect of it. I love a horror host anyway, and this is basically, essentially, he's a prototype horror host, right?
Mm.
So I find that really interesting. It very different to, you know, when I was growing up, I was seeing Elvira and Mistress of the Dark and people like that. And Rod Serling's quite different to her. But I really enjoy this aspect of it. You know, the moment I saw this, I was like, okay, I'm looking forward to seeing him every episode. It's not something that, I don't know, is there anybody out there who feels that he's getting in the way of the story? I don't know. For me, it works.
Obviously, I love it too. This is a bit of an older Rod Serling, a bit more lines on his face. He's in colour now. But you're right, he's got that class about him, that really distinctive voice, and he talks like in a very unique sort of beat poet style. You know, that he has a rhythm to his speech like no one else.
Mm.
I always talk about in The Twilight Zone that in that he is like this being from The Twilight Zone, this sort of emissary, this god, this guide, this something or other. He's the man who knows all the secrets, and he's going to let us have a little glimpse of them as well. So, you know, I love this stuff. I eat it up. But, you know, he shows us this painting, and then we go to our first story. Now, the setup is we have this old man, and he's clearly had maybe a stroke or something like that, and he's being looked after by his butler, Portefeuille. So we've got a really great cast here, I think, to start with. We've got Ossie Davis, who, you know, is pretty much great in everything he does.
Yeah.
But then we have the arrival of Roddy McDowall. Now, Roddy McDowall's a bit of a, in a sense, he's sort of sailing royalty. He was in The Twilight Zone. He's in this. He will then go on to be in Planet of the Apes, which was written by Rod Serling. So he's kind of Twilight Zone royalty. And he turns up, and he has quite a distinctive personality, doesn't he?
Oh boy, does he arrive, Tom. He arrives. Wow. This is a lot of this is strung around Roddy McDowall's neck through a lot of it. He has to carry it. He's certainly the one who spits out the most dialogue in it.
Mm.
And yeah, he's sort of horribly effervescent in a hugely arrogant way. He's not a very nice man at all, is he, Tom?
No.
Or Roddy McDowall. Jeremy, I believe, was his character's name.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and he arrives, and boy, does he arrive. I mean, he is chewing up scenery left, right, and centre. He practically ate the cameraman, Tom. I mean, he's going for it. But in a way that's really sort of, I couldn't quite take my eyes off him.
Yeah.
Because he's going sort of a mile a minute. You know, of course, there's the... it's certainly... I don't know if it's infamous to the people who've seen this show, but it's infamous to me. Spotify? he practically says it every line, every other line.
Yeah.
That's the name of Ozzie Davis's character. And, yeah, wow, he comes in and kind of steals the show, doesn't he?
He does. There's one point where he says Portafoy twice in the same sentence. And he's like, so Portafoy, blah, 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 Portafoy. You know? Yeah. I do wonder whether it was in the script or not, or whether this is something he's just brought to it, because he just really kind of goes for it. He does chew up the scenery, but I think he's so great to watch in it, because you do love him and hate him at the same time. You hate him for what he's doing, but you love him because it's Roddy McDowall just seemingly having a blast with what he's doing.
Well, I'm a big fan of Roddy McDowall anyway. Mm. So for me, it was strange, because there is a duality when I'm watching it, in that I really don't like this character. He's a really horrible, sleazy sort of... Ooh, a rat. He's a rat, Tom. Coming in there, trying to take advantage of this poor man. But at the same time, it's Roddy McDowall, and he keeps saying Portafoy all the time, and I can't help but, you know, I find him very magnetic anyway.
Yeah,
Roddy McDowall, and even, you know, even under the makeup for when he in Planet of the Apes and the movies he was in, I've always found him to be quite a magnetic presence, and very much so here. This is very much his show, but that's not to take away from the other elements around him. I mean, he's certainly the big antagonist here. It's interesting to have a villain who's this sort of... All he cares about is money at the end of the day. That's all he cares about is money. Doesn't care about his uncle at all. All he cares about is money. So it's interesting. A villainous character with charm, which is... You know, some of the best villains have that, don't they?
We've got three stories to get through here, so we won't spend a huge amount of time on each one, but we'll give each one its due. But I think what's interesting is that he doesn't come in and try and sort of win anyone over. He doesn't put on a performance to try and say, oh, I'm really a nice guy, but actually I want to kill my uncle and get his money, kind of thing. I mean, he keeps the fact that he's going to kill his uncle under his hat, but he's unabashedly saying, I'm only here for the money, you know. That's what I'm here for. You know, it's funny, something's just sprung to mind, a connection between these two shows, because when I used to work in New York when I was younger, on this one occasion, I can't remember why, but I ran out of the restaurant that I was working in. I had to be somewhere or something, and I legged it out the door, and I ran past this guy. And when I went back, you know, 20 minutes later or whatever, one of the staff said to me, do you realise who you just ran past? And I was like, no. And they said it was Roddy McDowall, because he lived in that town. And I was like, oh, man, I missed Roddy McDowall. You know, I would have at least said hello to him, you know. So, but there's actually a connection there with the next show we're going to talk about, but I'll get to that later.
Interesting. Didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so he kills his uncle. He wheels him over to the window, and he ends up... passing away. So Portafoy, you would think that he would leave, but when he finds out that he's only getting $80 a month, he decides he's going to stay. And there's a painting on the wall of the house and the family cemetery that is nearby. And as Jeremy's sort of gallivanting around with his women and drinking his brandy, he notices that it's starting to change on a daily basis. So knowing what you know about the show, obviously I'd seen this before, but what are your thoughts at this point?
It's interesting. You know, I had heard that Night Gallery was a show that was chiefly about supernatural horror.
Mm.
So I had it in my mind that this was going to be something that was supernatural based. And we'll talk about the conclusion of it in just a moment. But I got to grips with it fairly quickly and realised that this was about seeing a man, an incredibly arrogant, egotistical man who only cares about one thing, being slowly driven out of his mind.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things, you know, it's kind of a strange comparison to make, but it's one of the reasons why I love Evil Dead 2, for example, is that you get a character like, you know, Bruce Campbell plays Ash in it, just going out of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's sort of heading towards lunacy in that film. Roddy McDowall kind of going along the same lines, not as wacky, But I enjoy seeing, you know, the effervescent, villainous Roddy McDowall character, Jeremy, here, looking at that painting, being confused by it, looking at it again, wondering what the hell is going on, and very quickly in his own mind, coming up with the conclusion that his uncle is in fact coming back to get him.
Yeah.
So a story of revenge, which is, in a lot of these kinds of stories, and it's revenge seems to be a theme of a lot of anthology stories, I think.
Definitely, definitely. Now, the thing is, we find out that it's a plot by Portefeuille, that he is changing the painting on the wall, you know, at various intervals, so it looks like the old man is coming back to get him. Now, this obviously presents quite a big plot hole, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Yeah. I don't know about this one, Tom. It's in terms of that plot point. You would have to do it well.
I mean, just to make it clear what we're talking about, you can go with it for a while, but then there's a point where Roddy McDowall, he's really cracking up, and he gets on the phone, he's trying to call the police or whoever, and the painting literally changes while he's sat there. So yeah. Portefeuille would have needed to swing in there like a ninja or have someone do it like a ninja and change that painting while he sat there. I think it's something that they could have quite easily worked around if he'd have just went in the next room to use the phone or something and came back and the painting had changed. So quite why they've done it that way, I guess maybe for effect, but it is a bit of a plot hole, isn't it?
I'm not 100% sure about this because I've only seen the episode once, but I'm pretty sure there's one point where he looks at the painting, looks away from it and looks back and there's already been a change. So how would he have changed the picture within sort of 3 or 4 seconds? I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure there is a point where he kind of looks at it, looks away, looks back, and there's been another change since he last looked at it. But the good thing about this particular story is that I actually don't mind that much,
right?
Because I'm enjoying the conceit of it, which is just a quite a horrible, nasty man getting his comeuppance and going out of his mind in the process. You know, the conclusion of it, the fact that, you know, he gets scared out of his mind so much that he ends up falling down a fairly small flight of stairs and breaks his neck. The fact that he died at the bottom of it. It's all convenience, isn't it, really, at the end of the day? The story ends in a very convenient way for old Ossie Davis. But I have to say, I didn't mind that much that there was a gaping plot hole in the way, the actual device of how they got it done. It's problematic if you look at it objectively and look at it critically, but I didn't mind it. I have to say, I didn't mind. I was just enjoying the conceit of it.
Good. Well, I'm glad. Now the ending is quite interesting because we're on Portefeuille's side for most of this, but it seems that once he has executed this plan, and you know, to be fair, I don't think we mind that much. You know what I mean? That he is sort of done this to Jeremy. We're all right with it in the realms of fiction that this has happened, and he's going to inherit the money and the old man's estate. But it seems that once he knows that, he changes his personality and it becomes quite rude in his own way as well, which is a bit unfortunate. And then we get this ending, don't we?
Yeah, which is, I mean, because we spend most of the episode on as you say, on Potiphar's side, and so we. It's quite strange, isn't it, at the end of it, to see the personality change. All of a sudden, he's wearing that bright pink gown. He's, you know, walking around. He's inherited money, so he's happy about that. But yeah, we get that aspect of supernatural horror coming in, where he looks at the painting on the wall and it's changing, Tom. Mm-hmm. And it looks like old Jeremy's coming back from the dead. Now, I want to ask you, is that what we're meant to believe at the end of it that actually, yes, there is something supernatural going on within that cemetery?
I think so. It's a bit of a well-worn trope probably now, you know, setting something up to look supernatural and then there is something supernatural. Or you could say that maybe Portefeuille's gone mad or something like that. I don't know. I don't know. But I think that is the kicker. That's the twist. That something supernatural does happen and old Portefeuille gets his comeuppance as well. But, you know, it's interesting. I think with this one, you know, a lot of Rod Serling's work just it does have subtext and lessons and this, that, and the other. But I think this is him just trying to tell a scary yarn, a bit of a creepy story. And I think for the most part, it works. Obviously, you and I are seasoned horror fans. We don't get scared easily. But but as a bit of a televisual thrill, I think this is a good start.
I agree. And Roddy McDowall is the MVP in this one. You know, mm-hmm. I just couldn't get over how ridiculous he was. The fact that he kept saying Podify, the fact that he is, a real magnetism with him in this. And I think he really sells it. He sells the madness quite well. And yeah, like we say, a bit weak in terms of what the actual twist of the story is. But overall, I really enjoyed this.
Good. Okay, well, we've got three to get through. So let's get on to our second one, which is the story Eyes.
You must understand something, Miss Menlo. In the first place, the best you could expect, well, assuming the transplanting of the central optic nerve was successful, would be, well, roughly 11 to 13 hours of sight, no more. Then you'd be blind again. And then, of course, there's that other insurmountable obstacle.
What is the insurmountable obstacle?
Put it simply, Miss Menlo, you need a donor, someone who'd be willing to part with his sight for the rest of his life to give you roughly 12 hours of it. I don't believe there's such a person around.
Nonsense, Doctor. Everyone has a price.
For their eyes? I seriously doubt that.
Well, I tell you wrong. My lawyer has found such a person for me. He represented him in a criminal case some time ago. The man needs the money desperately. He's agreed to become the donor and part with his eyes for a sum of cash.
How much cash?
$9,000.
Written by Rod Serling and directed by Steven Spielberg. Never heard of him again.
No.
So Claudio Menlo is a 54-year-old millionaire who lives alone in a splendid penthouse above New York. Blind from birth, Claudio carries an inner rage at the misfortune of her situation. Instead of channeling this into something positive, she uses her wealth to amass an art collection in case the day comes when her sight can be returned. That becomes a possibility if she can only receive a groundbreaking optic nerve transplant. The only drawbacks are that she will only see for 12 hours, and also that the donor of the optic nerve must be alive. But her physician, Dr. Heatherton, refuses to carry out the surgery under circumstances that would cause the donor to be left sightless. But we also discover that Menlo has a talent for exploiting people, whether it's through the dirt she can dig up on Dr. Heatherton or the gambling debt she promises to pay off for the hapless Sidney Resnick, who agrees to give up his sight for a measly $9,000. Menlo receives the surgery, but when the moment comes for her to see the world for the first time, things don't quite go to plan. So here we have Steven Spielberg. Now, I think although he directed some shorts and student films and that kind of thing, I think this was his first actual television directing job. So, you know, I think when you hear that and you know it's really early Spielberg, you kind of start to watch it, don't you? Thinking, can I see what, you know, he's going to become here, don't you?
Absolutely. It's a funny thing. Again, I try to go into, normally I don't do this, but I try to go into Night Gallery knowing as little as possible about it, other than some very basic information, because I wanted to kind of view it as, you know, as somebody who might have discovered it watching the TV back then.
Yeah.
And the moment I saw directed by Stefan Spielberg on there, I immediately thought, ooh, is this his first job?
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly a very early one. I knew that this was, you know, sort of early 70s, late 60s. So I knew that this was pre-Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can you imagine that in the space of, what, if this was 69, Jaws was 74,
wow.
I think. So we're talking about within the space of 5 years, the man created the Hollywood blockbuster as we know it today. And it's funny to think that this is where he kind of started. So, yeah, you do sort of start to look at it and think, okay, now I'm watching this, you know, primarily because of the story, but also because I kind of want to see if there are any hallmarks of the Steven Spielberg directing style that we've kind of taken to Jaws and then Indiana Jones and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And yeah, an interesting story for Steven Spielberg to tackle, I think. Mm-hmm. Very interesting, with a couple of great actors in it, especially Joan Crawford, who we'll talk about in just a moment. But yeah, as far as directing, as far as Steven Spielberg, I was very surprised to see that he would do a story like this. And it does go to show that he did always have an eye for thrillers, mm-hmm. I think. Even though he's known for sort of making the big blockbuster family film, you know, his latest film, Ready Player One, is like, it's hard. Can you imagine that this is, you know, 1969, he makes this, flash forward to 2018, and he's releasing, you know, Ready Player One. It's like, it's an amazing, isn't it, what can happen to somebody in their career.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we saw it a lot in The Twilight Zone as well. And it's what I love about The Twilight Zone and Night Gallery, when you see, whether it's behind the camera or in front of it, when you see these people who would go on to bigger and better, well, not necessarily better, but bigger things or other things or things that will make them more famous. And we see it a lot in The Twilight Zone, people like Leonard Nimoy in a small little bit part before he became Spock, that kind of thing. So there's always going to be that person who sort of gets their start. And because anthologies go through so many people, there's always a good amount of these kind of things going on. So this is our setup. And again, we won't spend a huge amount of time on it because we've got three stories to get through. But the setup is, we have this lady, Menlo, who is this millionaire who hasn't been able to see since she was born. But people who are sightless do amazing things and sometimes put the rest of us to shame with their drive, what they're able to accomplish in that way. And it seems that she has accomplished a lot, unless she was born into money, I don't know. But, you know, she's let that sort of affect her in such a negative way that she seems to be just a ball of hate, doesn't she? A ball of rage. She's angry at the world for what's happened to her. And obviously the actor who's playing her is Joan Crawford. So we've got this really interesting meeting of the new Spielberg with the veteran Joan Crawford. He must have been so nervous coming into this.
Absolutely, because Joan Crawford, you know, from memory, could be quite demanding, right?
Mm.
So it's interesting, new Hollywood meeting old Hollywood. Yeah. You know, and Hollywood legend is what she is. And yeah, the character, you know, parallels with the last story in that it's somebody who desires something so much that they're willing to do anything to get it, and then they find out that actually maybe it's not something they wanted at the end of the day, because it can only bring bad luck with it. You know, it's a bit like making a wish that has dire consequences, but it allows mm-hmm. you to have a vast sum of money for a period of time to do a certain thing that you really want to do, but at the end of it, you know, would good things come bad things sometimes? And this story is another great example of that. There's this woman here who's blind. She has this dog. I mean, there are three sort of central characters in here. There's her, there's the doctor, and then there's the guy who's going to be the donor, who we'll get to in a moment. Okay, so the conceit of it is that, you know, she wants to have her sight back. And the doctor says to her, well, look, okay, I've got this method of doing it. I don't want to do it, though, because you will only have, if I do this method, involving optic nerves and you know, taking eyes from somebody else, you'll only have 12 hours of it. So I'm not going to, you know, consent to giving you somebody else's sight that they could use for the rest of their life. Why would I do that? So, you know, Tom, what does she do here to make him, to convince him to do the operation?
Well, this is her talent. She seems to be able to hone in on people's weaknesses or the dirt that she can dig up on them and use that against them. She's a manipulator.
Yeah.
And there's a great book. It's like the Bible of the Night Gallery, and it's called Rod Serling's Night Gallery, an After Hours Tour. And it's by TV historian Scott Skelton and Jim Benson. You mentioned before that Crawford could be quite a handful, and you're absolutely right from what they wrote in this book. Basically, what they say is she was furious that this 22-year-old director, Steven Spielberg, had been given the job to direct this episode. But although that was her true feeling, she tried to also be a bit of a friend to him. Right. So they had a relationship on two levels where they met and she was like, you know, I know you're only new, but I've got a bit of clout. I'm going to be a friend to you. If you've got any trouble with the studio, you let me know and I will take care of it for you. Now, she confided in him about Rod Serling's dialogue. She's like, people just don't talk that way. And as we go through this, I think you'll start to pick up on Rod Serling's dialogue, because although it can be incredibly poetic, like, I've tried to read some of his, like, excerpts of his stories on the Twilight Zone podcast, and you end up tripping over your words because it's wonderful, it's poetic, it has this beat poetry kind of aspect to it. But it can be incredibly hard to say sometimes. So
yeah, nobody talks like that.
Yeah. So I can kind of see where she's coming from. So she's confiding that in Spielberg, but then she's going to Serling saying, who's this kid directing this show? Now, here herself, she comes on set with an entourage with a case of vodka and a load of Diet Coke, and she's getting, you know, drunk on vodka in her dressing room all the time. Spielberg's running around trying to get her on set, trying to do what he can without her, that kind of thing. So it was an incredibly stressful time for Spielberg doing this episode. So the story of it is in the book, and it really is quite interesting.
Well, I wrote down the name of the book there because I'm really interested in reading more about that story. I have to say, I'm not surprised to hear it, because you can just sort of tell, you know, Steven Spielberg, it's probably his first, you know, his first big proper directorial job. And you've got Joan Crawford there, who's infamous, who has terrific presence on screen, no doubt about it at all. And that voice, and, you know, there's a reason why she was so famous. But yeah, I can imagine she was a real handful here. That's no surprise at all. But that sounds like a wonderful anecdote. He probably looks, I would imagine, Stephen, based on, you know, with all the stuff he's accomplished over the years, he probably looks back on it sort of quite fondly, really. It probably made him a better director at the end of the day.
So we meet Sidney, and we find out a bit of his story. And this is Tom Bosley, very famous actor as well. And we find out why he is willing to give up his sight. And at the conclusion, Menlo gets the surgery. And when the time comes to take off the bandages, there's a blackout.
Yeah.
I kind of feel that the way this is handled, in a similar way to the first one, it is a little bit of a plot hole.
Yes.
So I can forgive this one a little bit more, maybe. But basically, when she gets her sight back, there's a blackout. Now, this is very Twilight Zone-esque in its sort of poetry. She thinks that her sight only lasts for seconds. She sees the chandelier, and then it goes black. Even when all lights go off, yes, it can be incredibly dark, but you still have starlight, moonlight, that kind of thing. I think my only thought is maybe she doesn't have full sight, so maybe it is a little dimmer, so she can't really see those things. I mean, what do you think of any of this?
Yeah, if I was going to try to excuse it, I'd probably go along with the angle you've presented there, is that perhaps her eyes just weren't fully used to the light, because she's never, as far, was she blind from birth, I think?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
she's not used to processing light in any way. So it could possibly be that at the end of the day, what it ultimately comes down to is it's just a very convenient kind of twist in the plot, really. Very, very convenient. It's not often that just as you're about to see for the very first time, there's a citywide blackout and you can't see, you know, the shapes of anything in your own home or whatever. But yeah, I have to say that I think that, yes, again, a similar conceit to in the last story, in that, you know, the tables are turned here in a bit of a too convenient way. But I think this is crueler than that, because it's somebody who is not a very nice person, who is suddenly plunged into despair because they had a glimmer of hope that's now disappeared. And I found it quite sad, even though I don't really feel sorry for the character, because she's not very nice, and she, you know, she had to use blackmail to get the doctor to even do the operation. You know, I felt sorry for Tom Bosley's character because he's a bit of a sad sack and doesn't really, you know, he sort of laments the fact that he's going to lose his sight, that he will, you know, he'll probably cut his throat. I mean, it's quite dark, really, when you think about it. He'll probably cut his throat after a couple of weeks when he's sat and thought about it and he can't see anymore. Given to this woman just so she can have 12 hours worth of sight, it's a very selfish thing. But then when she's wandering around in the dark, completely lost all of a sudden, even though she's lived her whole life in darkness, but because she had a glimmer of hope there, all of a sudden it feels like she's truly plunged into darkness. I really found that to be quite a sort of dark and cruel twist, you know. And I felt a bit sorry for her, and I think that's the magic of this particular story, is that you can kind of feel sorry for somebody who's otherwise not very nice, who's a cruel manipulator. I think really there's a moment of beauty here where she wakes up and the 12 hours are nearly up and she sees the sun for the very first time.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's a beautiful thing, but taken away from her all too soon. And I can imagine for many, you know, somebody who's blind to see something like that, whether they're a good person or not, to see something that beautiful for the very first time and then to have it taken away from you is a very cruel move, I think.
It's a funny one, really, because this is a very Twilight Zone-esque ending, I think.
Mm.
There's always a sort of dark irony to it, and what people tend to put out into the world will often come back on them. And like you said, that's not necessarily a Twilight Zone thing, because I think we'll probably see that a lot in Tales from the Crypt as well. But it was very much present in a lot of Twilight Zone episodes, that if this is what you put out into the world, then this is what's going to come back to you.
Mm.
And, you know, she's made Tom Bosley's life dark, and so she's not been able to benefit from the light that his eyes would have given her. But the thing with the Twilight Zone is, although it's not explicitly said that the Twilight Zone is some sort of godlike force or anything, it is a kind of invisible presence in a way, like that you feel that something's pulling the strings in the Twilight Zone, that there is this sort of either godlike or something who's doing it. And I think it's clearly the way I view it, and I know a lot of the listeners view it. So whenever something like this happens, you think, well, this is the Twilight Zone kind of evening things up. So without it being the Twilight Zone, it's just the sort of ironic ending, because you don't get that same feeling that something's pulling the string. So it's really quite interesting, but I do think it's a really solid story as well. I really like this one too.
I like that. I like that as a concept, the idea that there is actually this invisible presence in the world that mm-hmm. is kind of, you know, okay, you've had your fun, but come back now, because there's a consequence to this. And I like that idea. Yeah, I mean, here it's just kind of a bitter ending for this woman, mm-hmm. who kind of gets what she deserves, really, at the end. I don't know if she deserved to die, but certainly she deserved to be, you know, in misery. And of course, as we've not said, she's so saddened by the loss of her sight again, just after she's seen the sun, that she heads towards the balcony and kind of goes through the window and falls to her death.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the end of Joan Crawford. And and that is indeed the end of a Stefan Spielberg, episode of Night Gallery, and a promising start for him as well. You know, it was interesting going into this. I thought I was just going to watch, you know, another episode of Night Gallery and to see a different story. And not only did I see that, I also saw kind of the beginnings, you know, not including obviously the Super 8 films and things that he made, but the beginnings of somebody who would go on to be probably the most famous film director of all time. So it's
yeah.
a remarkable thing, isn't it?
And I think there is some nice flourishes there, you know, when we see the doctor first walk in, that tracking shot down the corridor in the apartment, the way she's sort of scrabbling around in the dark, and it's completely dark except for her, the glass falling at the end. So there is some nice touches, and that's where you kind of think, okay, here's a bit of Spielberg coming through. So, shall we go on to our final segment?
Yeah, certainly. Let's do it. In a very different story, this one. Very different.
Okay, so let's go to the last story in the first Night Gallery, called The Escape Route.
Gretchen, talk to me for a moment.
What do you want to talk about?
Something happened last night, and again today.
What?
I was looking at a picture. Picture of a fisherman on a mountain lake. And after a while, it seemed as if...
As if what?
As if it were me in that boat. Just fishing. No pain. No running away, no... Looking over my shoulder.
What do you expect to see?
Ghosts.
Israeli ghosts.
Okay, The Escape Route, written by Rod Serling and directed by Barry Scheer. Joseph Strober is a Nazi war criminal hiding out in a squalid apartment in Buenos Aires. Sick of constantly looking over his shoulder, he becomes taken by the simplicity of a painting in the local museum. A fisherman without a care in the world, sitting in his boat. But nearby is a painting of a Jewish prisoner being crucified in a concentration camp. Strober begins to wonder if he wishes hard enough, could he put himself into the picture of the fisherman and get the freedom that he craves. After being recognized by a Holocaust survivor called Bloom, Strober is tracked down by some Nazi hunters who pursue him into the museum. In a last-ditch effort to survive, he kneels in front of the painting, asking God to let him escape into it. Now, this is one of Rod Serling's pet topics, the either the war itself or the Holocaust, the Nazis and, you know, what they did during the war, after the war, before the Twilight Zone, during the Twilight Zone, and now after the Twilight Zone. It's something that he returned to quite often. Now, there's this famous episode called Death's Head Revisited in the Twilight Zone about a Nazi going back to the prisoner of war camp after the war that he worked in during the war. But this one is a bit different. This time, we see a Nazi war criminal out and about in the world, trying to kind of keep his head down. So, yeah, very different. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, Tom, this is my first participation on the podcast that's Rod Serling related, and I think it's probably the best time for me to annoy all Rod Serling fans by telling their man Chu that this is my least favourite of the three stories. I didn't find a lot here to hang my hat on. I have to be honest with you. I get the central concept of it, I think, is kind of interesting. But I spent a lot of it thinking this is more or less an episode about a guy who looks at a painting quite a bit. So that's my take. And of course, there's more to it than that. You know, I'm being a bit facetious when I say that. But it's. I think the actor who plays it, who's the actor who plays the Nazi criminal here?
His name is Richard Kiley, I think.
Right, Richard Kiley. I didn't find a lot going on there. For I didn't find him particularly... Magnetic's a strange word to use for a Nazi war criminal. You know, that's probably not a word you want to use that often, but I didn't find a lot going on with him. Is there a feeling there of regret on his part? Because he has those discussions, doesn't he, with his neighbour. What do you make of that and his attitude towards the crimes that he committed?
It's funny. Our first disagreement in the episode, because this is actually my favourite one of the three. But I think because it's sort of Serling returning to themes that he's done before, so I think that's quite interesting. So maybe that's where that difference is between the two of us. Maybe that's why. It's funny you should touch on that part of it. You know, does he have regret? Because I think that... is the key for me. When he did Death's Head Revisited, that was a Nazi completely without regret. But I think what he's examining here is, does he have regret? Or is he just, you know, looking for forgiveness, or is he looking for freedom? You know, it's like someone saying sorry when they get caught doing something. And it's like, well, you're not sorry you done it. You're just sorry you got caught. And I think that's what he's really examining here, because sometimes, and quite bravely, I think, Serling is almost showing him in a sympathetic light, because, you know, he just wants peace. He just wants to go into that picture and have that peaceful life, you know, be that fisherman and not have to be constantly looking over his shoulder. But is that because he regrets what he's done? Or is it because he just doesn't like this life anymore? And I think that's the conflict, and that's what I find to be quite interesting in it.
Yeah, you put it in an interesting way. I mean, you always do. Whenever we have a disagreement about something, whether it's on the Stranger Deadly Show or anything else, you always put it to me in a way that makes me think about it in a different way. But I suppose my problem with it may be the actor. I mean, I don't find the story of this one... But I mean, you said it was written by Rod Serling, right?
Yeah, all these three are.
All three are, right. So it has that it must have, there must be a personal interest there based on what you said about the Twilight Zone and Death's Head Revisited. So in a way, I feel sort of like I've fallen at the first hurdle with Rod Serling, in that I've maybe perhaps I've misunderstood what he's going for here. Because I'm not a quote unquote Serling fan, only because I haven't, you know, seen much of the Twilight Zone and all the rest of it, not because I don't want to be. Perhaps it's just that I'm looking at it just as a story, and what I'm just not getting much from the story itself. I get the concept of what you're saying, that he's looking at this painting, that it's that he's looking at it mournfully in a way, that he wants that life, that that would be a better life for him. But I don't get much out of the actor. I don't feel that it's a three-dimensional kind of performance. You know, for me, the scene that I liked the most in it was when he's laying in bed and his neighbour's laying in bed on the other side of the wall, and they're just having this conversation back and forth. And she kind of tells him some things that are true about himself and about his crimes. And that was that's the scene I enjoy the most in this. Perhaps I am... Like you say, perhaps it's just a difference in us, in that I think perhaps when it comes to anthology stories, maybe I prefer the vengeful sort of twist to it and the supernatural aspect of it. Although this has got a supernatural aspect to it as well. In fact, we'll get to towards the end of it. But this is my least favourite of them. But I also understand what you're saying. It's one of those things where, if I watch this again, I might think of it in okay, Rod Serling has covered this before. Maybe if I saw what he did in The Twilight Zone with something that was thematically similar, it might make more sense to me. So I'm looking at it as a story itself. I would say, moving towards the end of it, you know, I'm not super fond of the actor playing this particular role. It doesn't stand out for me particularly. I mean, if I could ask you, actually, before we go to the conclusion, what is it about this that makes it your favourite one? Is it the Serling connection being more akin to what he would do in The Twilight Zone that's kind of selling it better to you?
I think that's a big part of it. And I think when we go on, because this often comes up in the Strange and Deadly show too, I think I'm conditioned in a way from The Twilight Zone because I know about Rod Serling. I know the levels he puts into things. On the surface, it might be a story about, you know, aliens coming and turning the lights off in a little town or what have you, but there's always those layers there. And I think in examining The Twilight Zone for so long, I'm quite conditioned to looking for those things. And that's not to say that you don't, but I think I do pick up on Serling-isms, if you like, and I know about his life when he was in the war and that kind of thing. So all that probably does come into play. I think it comes into play a little bit in The Strange and Deadly show too. Sometimes we'll watch a film and I'll be like, well, this is one's about the relationship between a father and a daughter. And you're like, mate, it's about a guy who feeds people to pigs. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? But I think looking at The Twilight Zone for so long, it has conditioned me in a particular way. And that's why I do look at this. And I like the actor. I think we differ in that regard. I like what he did. But... It is a very kind of Serling script. I mean, we talked before about people don't talk that way, and you've got this sort of woman of the night who he talks to through his wall, and I think it's her who calls, who says, or it's someone who says, "You are black uniform gods who put barbed wire around the world," you know?
Yep.
And who talks like that? But that's... the sort of beat poetry aspect of Serling's dialogue. So I think it is this aspect of, okay, the war's over, you've done these horrible things, and now you're hiding away. Where does your sorrow come from now? Does it come from the fact that you regret what you've done, or just the fact that you can't live your life in a peaceful way anymore because of what you've done? You know, and can we really have sympathy for a person like this? But ultimately, and it's the same in Death's Head Revisited, I think Serling's sort of takeaway from it is that their crimes were so great that no, you can't have, because I mean, let's get to the end, and because we are running kind of long with this three story one in the Night Gallery. But he's being chased by Nazi hunters and he goes into the museum and he's kneeling in front of the painting, and he's like, please God, get me. But he always asks for peace, but he never asks for forgiveness. And I think that's the key. And that's why, and again, this is a very Twilight Zone-esque thing that happens to him. Maybe if he'd asked for forgiveness, he would have been in that fishing boat. But I think Sailing's message is, no, their crimes were too great for any kind of forgiveness. But he presents this character in a way where at times we maybe even do feel a bit of sympathy for him. So I think that's why I prefer this one.
Now, see, I took that a slightly different way, and I may be wrong about this. Again, had you seen this episode before?
A few years ago, yeah. Uh-huh.
You had, okay. So this is my first time viewing it, so it may be I could go back and look at the ending again and be like, no, actually, this isn't the case. But what I took away from it was that when he goes into the gallery, it's dark in there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the reason he ended up in the crucifixion painting was because he knelt in front of the wrong painting.
Yeah.
That's what I took away from it. Am I wrong about that, or is that...
No, you're completely right. That's exactly what happened. They moved the paintings because the other one was on loan and it got took away.
I take on board fully what you said, Tom. You know, I think it's more likely that it's Serling just saying maybe this guy didn't earn forgiveness, and he's not asking for forgiveness. He's asking for, you know, the chance to be peaceful somewhere, and perhaps he doesn't deserve it. But that's what I took away on more of a surface level, I suppose, is that the reason why he ended up in the wrong painting is because he was kneeling in front of the wrong painting, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and again, if it feeds into this sort of aspect of the Twilight Zone being this kind of force, and again, it's not explicit in that show, but it's the way I kind of view it. Yes, the painting moved and he was in front of the wrong painting because they'd moved it. But the real reason behind that is that, you know, these things were put into place, the things manoeuvred in a particular way because of who he is and what he's done. Well, that's my takeaway from it anyway. But interesting, you know, I'm going to be really interested to see how you kind of tune into the Sailing way of writing things as we go along. Now, unfortunately, Night Gallery isn't completely his work. There's a lot of stuff by other people in it. So, you know, I'll have to make sure we point out which ones are written by him as we go.
Yeah, I mean, it's an aspect of the human personality and the human mind that we all sort of see things in different ways, really. And it's a weird thing, isn't it? When you think about it, you think we've all got a brain, perhaps we'll see patterns, we'll recognise things in the same way. But I also think that you have so much experience of the Rod Serling universe, his works, his writings, the TV work that he did. You know him so well that I think that you'll be able to look at that. And like you were saying in your earlier example, talking about some of the Strange and Deadly stuff, you pick up on Serling-isms.
Yeah.
Whereas I, because I don't know that so well, you know, it would be different if you were coming on to me, one of my great, you know, sort of specialist, quote unquote, expert. I don't like to consider myself an expert of anything, but I'm a big fan of martial arts movies and Shaw Brothers and stuff like that. If you and I were doing like a Kung Fu podcast together and you were looking at the surface stories, I would be able to come in and say, well, actually, this is, but you know, sort of, this is a very Shaw Brothers sort of thing to do or whatever. It's interesting the way that you can kind of be influenced in that way by things that you already know. So I definitely think that one of the twists on this podcast will be that I'm, because I don't know that much about Rod Serling, I'm looking at the stories more than the writer behind them necessarily. That's interesting. I mean, the things that you've told me, and I always tell you this when you bring up points to me, when I say, oh, Tom, you know, I can't believe you like this thing. We did that on a Strange and Deadly thing a while ago, although it was, you know, slightly facetious. I'm not meaning to sort of be horrible to you about it. I will often go away from that thinking, well, actually, he said some things there that if I went and watched this again, I may have a different opinion of it because I didn't really think of it that way, you know. And that's one of the great things about discussing things with people is that you can kind of go, you must never be fixed in your opinion, you know. You must always be willing to try it. So, but I would say, you know, provisionally, this was my least favourite of the three.
Yeah.
I would say The Cemetery is probably my favourite.
Yeah.
It's just about there as well. But interesting points you make, Tom, interesting points.
Good talk on this first episode of Night Gallery. So just overall, before we move on to Tales from the Crypt then, what are you thinking of your first exposure to the show?
Really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Really, really enjoyed it. I mean, I was a fan. This is the thing, you know, I'm new to a lot of Serling stuff, but I'm not new to the concept of an anthology horror show. You know, you and I are big horror fans. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, I don't need to sort of acclimate myself to the concept of that. I think this is a strong pilot. You know, I don't know how it's going to differ from here on out. Often you'll find that a pilot of a show is actually quite different to the show that then follows
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And they start getting into the meat of it, and the tone of it can change sometimes. The amount of pilots that I've seen over the years that are very different to the show, the episodes that follow is remarkable. But at least two of the stories here I was really, really into. And that's, hey, that's bang for your buck. You know, if you look at films like Creepshow, Creepshow 2, not all of the stories are absolutely going to work for you, depending on who you are. Uh-huh. But most of them do. So, yeah, the MVP award for me goes to Roddy McDowell out of all of it. And if I can say it one more time, Podify, that will live in my memory for quite a while. Old Roddy. But yeah, I really enjoyed this, Tom. This was a great introduction. I can't wait to get into more. And I just have to say, to kind of close that off, I love Rod Serling coming in.
Uh-huh.
He walks in there like a boss. He's suited and booted. He comes in there, introduces the painting. And at the end of it, he's basically just like, right, get out now. And then he's going to come back next time. And yeah, there's something superbly classy about the man.
Good, good. Okay, well, now it's time for me to sit back and put my feet up and listen to you talk a little bit about Tales from the Crypt. So over to you, Chris.
So it's Strange and Deadly's Television Terror, and we're going to cover Tales from the Crypt, starting right at the beginning. Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Well, let me tell you a bit about Tales from the Crypt before I bring in my good friend Tom here to tell me a bit about Tales from the Crypt and his history with it. So Tales from the Crypt's roots are found in its origin as a bi-monthly comic book anthology series published by EC Comics. It debuted in the 1950s, running for 27 issues. British film production company Amicus Productions would release a standalone adaptation of several EC stories in 1972 entitled Tales from the Crypt. The Crypt Keeper here was played by Ralph Richardson. Amicus released a further adaptation of AC Comics stories entitled Vault of Horror. It wasn't until 1989 that the Tales from the Crypt brand would be cemented in the minds of the television-watching public, particularly in America, when HBO debuted the legendary TV series. The Crypt Keeper, voiced by actor John Cassia, became an icon. Offering humour and plenty of puns, the character would feature in segments at the beginning and end of an episode, bookending each story. His iconic cackle rumbles in the ears, as does his signature usage of boils and ghouls as he prepares another spooky tale for the viewer. Tales from the Crypt spawned 7 full seasons, a Saturday morning cartoon, I remember that, named Tales from the Crypt Keeper, that ran for 3 seasons, and 3 feature-length movies, in addition to other related spin-offs. Now, Tom, we are not going to cover, because we're sticking mostly to the American TV show and, of course, the movies and things like that, mm-hmm. on that side of it. What are your memories of the old 70s movie, Tales from the Crypt, released by Amicus?
You know, I don't think I've ever seen it. Or if I did, I've completely forgotten about it. So for me, I've known of it, but for me, Tales from the Crypt has always been this show, really.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I actually was confused by it when I was younger because I knew the TV show, and then I would looked at this old British movie that had the same title, and it's got Joan Collins in it.
Yeah.
Actually, in one of the stories that's going to be covered in this very season, this very first season that we're going to get to here. Interesting movie, but no, for me, it's always been about the TV show. Did you ever read any of the EC comics?
You know, I did spend a bit of time quite fascinated with them, because when you hear of the history, you know, the way there was all the uproar about the violence in them and the gore and that kind of thing, it's quite an important time in comic history, isn't it? So I did get a few of the collections back in the day. I really can't remember them now, but I think often the best thing about them was the covers, you know? Mm. Some beautiful covers, and the stories, a lot of the time, if I remember, I don't want to diminish them for anyone who loves them, a lot of the time it was just an excuse to get to some gruesome ending, you know, where someone had their face ripped off or something like that. But, you know, it's been a while since I've read them, but I did for a time.
Well, the comics still hold up. I mean, I've got various collections of vintage horror comics. digital, sadly, not actual physical ones, but digital collections of them, and they still hold up. There's some great artwork. Yeah. There's a lot of them are black and white, of course. Really interesting stuff, really interesting. And considering the time period in which they were released, fairly dark as well. This is the thing about it, and that's what you're going to see with Tales from the Crypt. Some of these stories get super dark. But tell me about the TV show itself then. What are your sort of earliest memories of becoming acquainted with the Tales from the Crypt HBO series?
Well, I never saw it on the original HBO. You know, I used to live in New York about, God, 20 years or so ago now. Mm-hmm. And I would come home every night from work and I would watch Star Trek The Next Generation and then Tales from the Crypt. But it's my understanding that when they put Tales from the Crypt on television, that it was in a cut down version on cable.
Right.
So I've never actually seen them uncut. And, you know, obviously the one we're going to be looking at tonight, there's swearing, there's nudity in it, those kinds of things. I've never seen any of them in that form. So this journey that we're going on, that aspect of it is going to be quite new to me.
That's it. I mean, some people think rather naively that Game of Thrones was the first HBO show that showed sort of nudity and swearing and violence. Not the case, folks. HBO has been, you know, known for it. It was one of those channels where you could kind of show anything you wanted within reason. But yeah, Tales from the Crypt, and I think was a good home for it because you're able to show more of these stories. You're able to show them in a more violent way, in a way that, you know, there's not as many restrictions that are placed upon you. So it seems like HBO was the right home for it.
It's funny that, you know, you and I talk about Night Gallery as well, and that's no nudity, no swearing, no particularly harsh violence in it. So the juxtaposition between the two shows is really quite interesting. But, you know, I love gore, I love violence, not in my day-to-day life, but in my entertainment, because I think that's where it should stay. And as long as you can differentiate between the two things, then that's the main thing. So, I'm looking forward to these uncut Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them to get through. And there's a lot of them I haven't seen. I mean, this is the thing. You presenting Night Gallery to me, I believe you were saying that, you said to me before that you haven't seen all of Night Gallery. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen all of Tales, but it's one of those things. And there are a lot of TV shows that are like this for me. You mentioned Star Trek The Next Generation. This is like it for me as well. I've seen lots of episodes out of order. So yeah. It's, you know, when we were beginning to prepare for this show, I told you that the first episode was one that's actually the second episode. I told you it was the first because in my mind that's what I remember seeing first, and for some reason I had it tagged as that. It's just one of those sad things about memory. Sometimes it kind of gets embedded in there. But I love a horror host, Tom, and there are a few horror hosts as iconic as your boy the Crypt Keeper, voiced by John Cassier. Would it be the same without him? Even though he doesn't factor into the stories, he bookends them. Would it be the same without the Crypt Keeper?
It's a very American thing, isn't it, the horror host? Mm. I think we've only really had one on television. I think his name was something like Dr. Walpurgis, and he was this sort of really made-up creature guy. Mm-hmm. But it's very much a staple in American television and one I wish we had more of. But yeah, what a great one. This one is the Crypt Keeper and this puppet, you know, the sort of animatronic thing. I love the guy.
Would Emily Booth count as a horror host these days?
Oh, true. We do have her.
Yeah, as a kind of modern day.
Yeah. I think we might have had a few on the sort of, you know, the cheapy horror channel type things, but America seems to do it better, I think.
So, Tom, let me ask you this. Before we get stuck into tackling this episode of Tales from the Crypt, you've got two choices here of your favourite horror host. Now, I realise I'm not taking into account what your own personal choice would be, so perhaps you can throw one in if you have one that's different to these two. But you've got the Crypt Keeper and you've got Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Who are you going for?
Okay, all right. I'm going to have to go with Elvira for two reasons. She's funny and she's beautiful. So yes, I'll stick with those.
Are you sure those are all the reasons you've picked? Tom, are you sure you don't want to expand on that? Fair enough.
No.
Is there anyone else you would have thrown in there, or is that?
Not really, because that's the thing. We're just not as exposed to them over here. You know, I spoke briefly about that British one they did, and I wish they'd bring him back because he was a fantastic creation, Dr. Well, Pages, I think his name was, and he was they really done a good job on him. He wasn't just some dude with his face painted. He was this magnificent creature. But yeah, you can't beat Elvira, really.
Well, I mean, speaking personally, I would love if, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday night or something, there was, I mean, I don't know how mainstream you can be at 10 or 11 at night, but there was like a proper horror show with a host, a British host ideally, or an American host, whoever it may be, a proper horror show, maybe an anthology show, whatever it would be, introduced by a horror host. I think that would be a great tradition to bring back. And we see there are people on YouTube who are doing it. So it's kind of carried on in that way in a digital medium, but it seems like otherwise a very traditional American thing that we didn't really get over here. And that's a shame. I think we're missing out, really.
Definitely, definitely.
But we get a good dose of it here with John Cassier's Crypt Keeper. And of course, we get that classic intro coming into the house, going down into the crypt. And there he is down there cackling away, the rotten old sod, Tom.
Like a bobblehead.
Yep, bobblehead, put together with sellotape. But still, I don't know, Tom, there's something brilliant about how sort of weirdly puppet-like he is and how practical he is. He feels real to me.
Yeah, he's from that time, isn't he? The time of the practical effects. And I'm not a CG moaner, you know what I mean? I'm not someone who's constantly moaning about it. But just having him there as a real thing, I think, really counts for something.
Yeah, I mean, when they turned Yoda into CG, I was out. I prefer puppet Yoda. So, it's a Star Wars reference there. I agree with you. So now, Tom, let's begin our journey here with Season 1, Episode 1 of Tales from the Crypt. Now, this is The Man Who Was Death. What's interesting is that in this first season, some of the stories are actually not from Tales from the Crypt. They're from sort of offshoots of Tales from the Crypt, and this is one such story. Ah. This was adapted from issue 17 of Crypt of Terror. And this was directed by Walter Hill, Tom, who directed one of my favourite films, The Warriors.
Yeah.
And I would imagine probably a favourite of yours as well.
Definitely, definitely.
Country boy, but I like the city. You know? It's big, it's dirty, lets know what it really is. But at night, there's all those lights. It's real pretty, ain't it? My name's Niles Talbot. I've been the executioner in this state for the last 12 years. When I got here from Oklahoma, I caught on as an electrician, and after a while, I got a job out to the prison. Taking care of the generators. I like electricity. It's dependable. You can trust it. Let's say do it with gas or with some lethal injection. I don't take to that. That's how you kill a dog or a cat or something, not a man. It's gotta be the old electric chair for me.
Yes, the air date for this was the 10th of June, 1989, Tom. I was but a young lad. You, I believe, were in your 50s back then, something like that.
I think so.
Around there. And the main guy here, really, the actor who kind of carries the whole thing, is Bill Sadler. Now, what do you remember of Bill Sadler? He's a guy who, he's one of those character actors, isn't he, who you kind of see everywhere, and you don't necessarily remember his name, but he's got a great face for the screen, I think.
Yeah, he's one of those actors, isn't he, that you do see him in a lot of stuff, but he's often the supporting guy, so not necessarily in a lead role, so this is quite rare. You know, he's in the Marvel Cinematic Universe these days. He plays the president sometimes in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that kind of thing, but he's always a kind of welcome presence, I think.
Definitely, yeah. When you see him in it, you know that he's going to put in a good performance. He's a solid guy. So let me read you the synopsis of this one, and then we'll get stuck into discussing the episode. So, electrician Niles Talbot is a gleeful prison executioner. He relishes taking the lives of the criminals sent to his chair. After all, they committed the crime. They deserve the punishment. When the state decides to abolish the death penalty, Niles finds himself out of a job. Taken to the streets, he notices that crime continues unabated. Attending court cases, he sees criminals being released by the justice system and decides to carry his former role over to his new life. He tracks down and electrocutes those who got away. However, the police are beginning to track down this mysterious new killer. As luck, or rather misfortune, would have it, the state is about to bring the death penalty back, and Niles may be heading for the chair like the victims he once took glee in sending to hell. So, Tom, the man who would be death. So we begin here with a narration from... I mean, this is all done... he's breaking down the fourth wall throughout this. Is Bill Sadler, a.k.a. Niles Talbot, and he's talking to the audience, and he's telling them about his job. And it's a job that he rather enjoys, Tom, which is electrocuting prisoners in the old chair. He even makes a point of, you know, he says at one point, most of these guys, they don't make a point of looking the criminal in the eye before they pull the switch, but I do. So he takes glee in taking the lives of these men, doesn't he?
Yeah. What a great kind of way of hooking you in, though, don't you think? Because, you know, it's the first episode of a new series, and anthology shows, you're not setting up ongoing characters apart from the Crypt Keeper. So you really got to draw people in. And I think having them speak to the audience in that way, and he's got a job that whether you agree with the death penalty or not, you know, the people who do that job, it is a source of fascination for me. You know, what goes on in their head, how can they do what they do, that kind of thing. So to have one of them, an executioner, just talking to you in such a calm way, I think it is a really good way of introducing the show.
Definitely, really draws you in, and it makes you feel like you're part of the story because he's taking you along for the ride. Now, unfortunately, Tom, the state have decided to abolish the death penalty. Well, it's unfortunately for Niles, I should say, because, you know, this is not a show where we're going to discuss whether we agree with the death penalty or not. It's not really that kind of show. But Niles certainly doesn't agree with it, doesn't agree with the abolishment of it, because it means that he's out of a job. Now, he was an electrician at the prison, and he was hoping, okay, well, fair enough, I can't execute these prisoners. He was promoted to that job. I can't execute them anymore, but surely I can have my old job back and take care of the power generators down there. And they say, well, no, you trained somebody to take that job over. So in a way, he's set on his mission because he's basically been told, well, look, you're the old guard now, and there's new people who are coming in, so get out, go onto the streets, and you know, you're not wanted anymore. So that kind of starts off that attitude. And then we've got him kind of standing at that overpass there, talking to the audience again and narrating what's happening. And he goes to a bar, has a drink, sits down. But what he's noticing is that crime is continuing. Criminals are still going unpunished. And what's going to happen now that they're abolishing the death penalty? How are these guys going to pay for it? So I think it's a good conceit, isn't it, for an episode. This guy is a vigilante.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting is you wonder about him because he is quite personable, isn't he? You know, he's very calm. You know, he's not prone to fits of rage or anything like that. He just kind of talks to you very matter-of-factly. He's got a bit of a twinkle in his eye. And you do wonder, if he didn't have this outlet that his job gave him, would he be a killer himself anyway? Does he justify it to himself in that way? So when that job is taken away from him, is it really about justice, or is it just that he needs to kill? You know, and I'm not sure it explores it in much depth, but I think it's certainly there to kind of chew over.
But it's probably worth saying at this point that these episodes are only about half an hour long. So they haven't got that much time to develop it. And one of the great things about Tales from the Crypt is in a lot of the stories, not always, as is the case with anthology shows, but in a lot of the cases, they manage to convey everything they need to convey with a limited amount of time. So you haven't got, you know, I could imagine this stretching out to an hour potentially, and maybe we learn more about what his life is like, because we don't really learn anything about his home life, for example, what that would have been like. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he's not a million miles away from the Punisher in that he just sees bad guys as uniformly bad and doesn't see any good in them at all. And if there's a miscarriage of justice somewhere along the line, which unfortunately there are a lot of them in the real world, there's a miscarriage of justice, he's going to try and take revenge for that. So he's attending these different court cases, kind of sitting in the audience there. And he, you know, he notices these people who are getting let off. They're being sent out into the wild free. And he's not happy about that, Tom. He essentially becomes, for a little while, a serial killer.
That's right.
But he considers it being a vigilante. Now, I suppose the thing is, someone like the Punisher, for example, he wants to get the job done, and he's going to do it in a way that is sort of, you know, quick and easy to do. This guy, do you get the feeling that he enjoys killing people a bit too much?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the whole question, isn't it? You know, is it about the justice, or is it that he just likes killing people? But it's interesting, you said about it's only half an hour long. Man, when they cut these things down, they must have been like, what, you know, 25 minutes or something, 20 minutes, I don't know. But, you know, they used to play so many commercials in America that really used to pad things out. But I suppose it's not the smartest move, is it? That he's killing all these people with electricity and he's just been laid off as the executioner using the electric chair. It's not going to take long for someone to put two and two together, is it?
No, not at all. And, you know, let's not forget at the beginning of it as well, when he's taking one particular prisoner to the chair, they're sort of ranting and raving, panicking because their life is going to be over, and saying, yeah, no, the governor will call and intervene and stop this from happening. But he spent, you know, most of this episode being quite cool, calm and collected. Mm. He finds this couple and they've been released. One guy basically cheated on his wife, got his wife killed so he can run off with this young lady. Niles comes in and electrocutes them both in a hot tub.
Yeah.
And he takes on his final mission, doesn't he, Tom, at a strip club?
Funnily enough, the couple in the hot tub, the male actor is called Garrett Graham.
Mm.
And 20 years ago, when I used to work in New York, who used to come into the restaurant every day that I worked, the same restaurant that I almost ran into Roddy McDowall in, but Garrett Graham.
Wow.
So here's a little coincidence for you. But yeah, he used to come in every day. He used to cook him his dinner. Very, very nice chap, you know, kept himself to himself. Read a little book and ate his dinner. But yeah, very small part in this. But he is one of those sort of character actors who pops up in everything.
You see him everywhere, yeah. You recognise him. I didn't even know his name, to be honest with you, but I know his face. It's a funny thing, isn't it, about some of these character actors. You don't really know their name, but like Bill Sadler, I wouldn't be able to tell you his name offhand, but you see his face and you go, oh, it's that guy. I love that guy.
Yeah, the Shawshank guy.
Yeah, the Shawshank guy, which is an interesting parallel there as well, in that this is, you know, some of it takes place within the prison. Of course, Shawshank would be one of his most notable roles in terms of, you know, mainstream notice anyway.
Mm-hmm.
On such a big sort of scale, because Shawshank Redemption is such a big enduring thing. And of course, he was a character in that. So, yeah, an interesting thing. Your restaurant sounds interesting, Tom. You're just in there meeting celebrities, man, cooking them dinner.
Everyone came in. Everyone. Rod Serling came in. No,
Dame Edna Everidge was in there.
Yeah. But no, occasionally you would get some, but it's just a crazy coincidence that on these occasions, two of the people who came in were in the shows we're discussing tonight.
So yeah, Tom, we are heading towards this man's final mission here, which is at a strip club.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman in the papers that he's seen as committed. I can't remember what crime she committed, to be honest with you, but she's dancing up in a cage. And we get some nudity here, Tom. And yeah, the HBO influence here. We get some nudity and some swearing here. I mean, that's the thing about Tales. Uncut, they're able to get away with more than what they could do on standard cable. It'd be interesting, actually, to see like the cut version of this, just to see. Obviously, they would have cut out any of the nudity or whatever. And it might have... I can only imagine it making the scene more choppy.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, did they... Because you sometimes hear of people filming airline versions of films, don't you, where, you know, they might do a more toned down of scene for something. I'm not sure if it's something they do these days, but I do wonder, did they do a scene where all the women had their tops on in the strip club, or did they just cut those bits out completely? You know, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I know Breaking Bad is an example of one of the early episodes of it. There's a woman in a window who is topless, and they actually put in on the versions they showed on TV, they actually digitally put a bra on her.
Oh, right.
And then obviously in the uncut version you see a nude. But yeah, he's sitting there at the bar looking at the woman, and he decides that he's going to electrocute her to death in the cage.
Uh-huh.
And he flips a switch, Tom, and nothing happens. As it would turn out, the police have been on his trail, and they come in and they get him.
Yeah.
And they capture him. And now, here comes the bit where we talk about a convenient plot. Because as he's taken in, he's being talked to, the guy's telling him there, well, as it happens, since you've been away, the state have decided to bring the death penalty back. So, you know, it's, what can you say about that, Tom? You know, it's convenient for the story, isn't it?
Yeah, and again, you know, without some sort of overriding force to bring these things, you know, our politicians can't get anything done, you know, for months on end, unless it's bombing a country or something.
Yeah.
You know, it takes them forever to decide on stuff. So, but these just bring it back.
He's out on the street for three weeks, and it's a convenient thing, but the good thing about it is that it draws parallels back to the beginning, where here's this guy who's been cool, calm and collected, who's taking criminals who are panicking. He's kind of treating them in a somewhat mocking way. Now, as he's being taken towards the electric chair, because they're going to give him the death penalty for committing these murders, as they're bringing him towards, he's panicking. And he's losing his cool, and he's saying, no, no, the governor will call. This is, you know, misunderstood. He'll help me because he knows what I did for this system. But they put him in the chair, and the narration at the it's you know, it's cruel in a way, because the narration at the end from him, he gets electrocuted in the chair. There's no getting out of this. Or in Tales from the Crypt, it's not that often that you'll see, you know, the person who is in a dire situation prosper. Yeah. It doesn't happen that often. So, you know, this guy is going to get electrocuted. But then the cruel bit is that his narration at the end, where he's like, this isn't going to happen. You know, they're not going to put me in that chair. But they do, Tom. They do. And that is the end of old Bill Sadler. Now, I think this is a very good start for this season. I think it's an enjoyable episode. It draws you in because you're being talked to by the character. I think Bill Sadler is a solid presence here, carries the whole thing really, because there's no other characters that have any depth to them other than him. Everything kind of hangs on him. How are you feeling about the beginning here, the man who was death?
I think it's a great start too. You know, it is short, especially in comparison to obviously what we've watched recently with Night Gallery and that kind of thing, but it seems to be just long enough, doesn't it? And you could have spread this out into a bigger story if you'd have wanted to. But just these bite-sized little things that don't take too long, they come and go, has a little sting in the tail, and a great sort of central performance by Bill Sadler, who, like you said, he talks to us, and pretty much a perfect first episode for getting you on board. Not that gruesome. I'm going to be curious to see how much blood is going to be in the future, or do they just have, you know, violence more sort of suggested by the way people move, that kind of thing. I'm going to be curious how bloody it actually gets, because I can't really remember.
Well, I won't spoil that for you then, in that case. I'll kind of let you be surprised by that. But yeah, it's interesting. I think what will be the most interesting thing for me is on episodes that I haven't seen, to see if there are stories where you get to the end of that half an hour and you think, oh, this needed another half an hour on top. Yeah. You know? Because, I mean, if you look at films like Creepshow, for example, Creepshow was released in 84, I think. So it was before this show came out. And it was inspired by EC Comics. But the segments on Creepshow, they're longer. And so you get to kind of get into the story and get out of it and still cover a lot of detail. This, I think, is perfect for what it is. But you could also imagine this maybe being a segment of something like Creepshow, couldn't you? And maybe having 40 minutes or so to flesh it out a bit more. But I think what we get here is quite good. I just like the idea of this kind of, this guy is basically a bit of a show-off because he was an electrician who got promoted to this executioner position. He's taking lives. And at the end of it, even though he's kind of making fun of these criminals who are falling to pieces at the end when they're about to lose their lives, at the very end of it, that's all he is.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
That's what he becomes, is just a snivelling, sad, crying man who doesn't want to die. and that is the thing about Tales from the Crypt, and I said it to you even on some of the Night Gallery stuff. Tales from the Crypt, so these stories, if you're going to be boastful, they will sometimes reward you with punishment. Yeah. Punishment isn't really a reward, but you know what I mean. So a good start, I think.
Yeah, definitely. You know, with us, mind you, that these episodes are going to be spaced in a particular way, you know what I mean? But I think it's going to be interesting to see going forward the variations on this kind of twist in the tail ending. You know, what you put out there comes back to you. You know, we might overdose on it by the end of this run, to be honest, because we're going to be seeing it so often. But, you know, it was used well in this one, even though that plot point is a bit of a convenience.
Yeah, definitely. We may just have to get used to that as being the reality, that sometimes you have to have a plot contrivance in order to get a good twist at the end of it. But so, yeah, Tom, how are you feeling about it? We've started on our journey of Tales from the Crypt. I'm feeling good.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to more. I wish we, you know, we're going to space these a particular way. I wish it could be more often. And sometimes it might be if we've got the time. But, you know, this is a good start and I'm looking forward to getting into more because it's clearly, you know, I think you said it is a bit trashier, but it's still a quality put together show, isn't it?
Oh yeah, and listen, some of the actors who arrive here throughout this season and the ones to follow, there's some great actors who come in, some great actors from the 80s and the 70s and so forth. So, you know, it's not like they're working with amateurs here.
No.
You get to see some really big people here. And let me just say this about the second episode. I don't want to spoil any plot stuff for you. All I'll say is you like 80s slashers, right?
Oh yeah.
And you're going to love the next episode, buddy. Or will you? Who knows? But that might be the order of the day. So that will be episode 2 of Tales from the Crypt on Strange and Deadly Television Terror next time around.
Okay, so that's our double bill of horror anthologies. Bit longer than usual, I think, because obviously the Night Gallery one was the pilot episode and the stories went on a bit longer. That's usually going to be an hour. So it sort of weighs slightly more in Night Gallery's favour. But, you know, this Patreon space is a rod sailing space, so that's okay. But you get this lovely sting in the tail with Tales from the Crypt. So, Chris, I've enjoyed it. You know, it's something new for us. And I think every time you start a new podcast, you're always kind of feeling your way through that first episode, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's rare that you're going to nail it the first time around unless you happen to be an experienced radio disc jockey, and neither of us are. But we've been doing this for a long time, podcasting. Of course, we do two other podcasts with each other, so we're pretty well used to each other. But it's just the material itself that is kind of quite new for you, especially for me on the Night Gallery side. So, but yeah, I've really enjoyed this, man. Thank you very much for having me on. This is, like you sort of said earlier on, you could have had somebody who was more of a Serling expert to come in, and that may have been interesting as well. But having me on there and being a bit green, I appreciate your time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I can't wait to get into more. You know, there's going to be some ups and downs the way that goes. It's not always going to be of this quality, but sometimes it's going to be higher quality as well. So there's that to look forward to. And Tales from the Crypt just seems to be a good time, so we will get into that too. So this is our first episode of Strange and Deadly's Television Terror. Like I said in the intro show, we'll commit to it being bi-monthly, but, you know, when we can, we might throw the odd monthly episode in as well. But we will see how it goes. But there's definitely going to be bi-monthly, and I look forward to the next one. Okay, Chris, anything from you before we go?
Not really, just, you know, thank you very much, and thank you to the patrons for supporting this. It's fantastic of you to do so. And I said it earlier on, but I kind of said it in passing, really. I have said this to you personally about 500 times, so but it'll be the first time on a podcast, I think, that I've said it. Congratulations on your awards win, my friend. You deserve that more than anyone I know. I'm super proud of you. I've known you for 11 or 12 years now, something like that. You know, it's been a long time now, and I've seen the Twilight Zone podcast go from strength to strength. It started at a grassroots level, just you doing it. You're not an industry back kind of guy, so the success of your Patreon is all down to you, man. It's all down to the one man machine that is Mr. Tom Elliott, and I couldn't be proud of you, man. Couldn't be proud of you, and I'm very, very happy for your success. You know, I was, as you well know, but nobody else does, I was up at 5:30 in the morning looking for the results, and then I had to wait till about 10 o'clock at night to tell anybody about it publicly. So you deserve it, my friend.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you, and I'm glad you're on board for this journey as well, and you can come into this world as well and see what it's all about. So
definitely,
that's going to be the joy of this show for me. So that is Strange and Deadly's Television Terror, and we will speak to you next time. You've been listening to Strange and Deadly's Television Terror, the Patreon-exclusive show for supporters of the Twilight Zone podcast, with music by Danny Davis and artwork by Dark Ink One, presented by Chris Clayton and Tom Elliott. All clips used in the show are the property of their copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.